Others, too, Rambert, for example, were trying to escape from this atmosphere of growing panic, but with more skill and persistence, if not with greater success. For a while, Rambert had gone on struggling with officialdom. If he was to be believed, he had always thought that perseverance would win through inevitably. And, as he pointed out, resourcefulness in emergency was up his street, in a manner of speaking. So he plodded away, calling on all sorts of officials and others whose influence would have had weight in normal conditions. But as things were, such influence was unavailing. For the most part, they were men with well-defined and sound ideas on everything concerning exports, banking, the fruit or wine trade, men of proved ability in handling problems relating to insurance, the interpretation of ill-drawn contracts, and the like, of high qualifications and evident good intentions. That, in fact, was what struck one most, the excellence of their intentions. But as regards plague, their competence was practically nil. However, whenever opportunity arose, Rambert had tackled each of them and pleaded his cause. The gist of his argument was always the same, that he was a stranger to our town, and that being so, his case deserved special consideration. Mostly, the men he talked to conceded this point readily enough, but usually they added that a good number of other people were in a like case, and thus his position was not so exceptional as he seemed to suppose. To this, Rambert could reply that this did not affect the substance of his argument in any way. He was then told that it did affect the position already difficult of the authorities, who were against showing any favoritism and thus running the risk of creating what, with obvious repugnance, they called a precedent. In conversation with Dr. Rieu, Rambert classified the people whom he had approached in various categories. Those who used the arguments mentioned above, he called the sticklers. Besides these, there were the consolers, who assured him that the present state of things couldn't possibly last, and, when asked for definite suggestions, fobbed him off by telling him that he was making too much fuss about a passing inconvenience. Then there were the very important persons, who asked the visitor to leave a brief note of his case, and informed him they would decide on it in due course. The triflers, who offered him billeting warrants, or gave the addresses of lodgings. The red-tape merchants, who made him fill up a form and promptly interred it in a file. Overworked officials, who raised their arms to heaven, and much harassed officials, who simply looked away. And finally, the traditionalists, these were by far the greatest number, who referred Rambert to another office or recommended some new method of approach. These fruitless interviews had thoroughly worn out the journalist. On the credit side, he had obtained much insight into the inner workings of a municipal office and a prefect's headquarters. By dint of sitting for hours on imitation leather sofas, confronted by posters urging him to invest in savings bonds exempt from income tax, or to enlist in the colonial army, and by dint of entering offices where human faces were as blank as the filing cabinets and the dusty records on the shelves behind them. The only thing gained by all this expenditure of energy, Rambert told Rieu with a hint of bitterness, was that it served to keep his mind off his predicament. In fact, the rapid progress of the plague practically escaped his notice. Also, it made the days pass more quickly, and, given the situation in which the whole town was placed, it might be said that every day lived through brought everyone, provided he survived, 24 hours nearer the end of his ordeal. Rieu could but admit the truth of this reasoning, but to his mind, its truth was of rather too general an order. At one moment, Rambert had a gleam of hope. A form was sent him from the prefect's office with instructions that he was to fill in carefully all the blanks. It included questions concerning his identity, his family, his present and former sources of income. In fact, he was to give what is known as a curriculum vitae. He got an impression that inquiries were on foot with a view to drawing up a list of persons who might be instructed to leave the town and return to their homes. Some vague information gleaned from an employee in one of the offices confirmed this impression. But on going further into the matter, and finally discovering the office from which the form had emanated, he was told that this information was being collected with a view to certain contingencies. What contingencies, he asked. He then learned that the contingency was the possibility of his falling ill and dying of plague. The data supplied would enable the authorities to notify his family, and also to decide if the hospital expenses should be borne by the municipality, or if, in due course, they could be recovered from his relatives. On the face of it, this implied that he was not completely cut off from the woman who was awaiting his return, since the powers that be were obviously giving heed to both of them. But that was no consolation. The really remarkable thing, and Rambert was greatly struck by this, was the way in which, in the very midst of catastrophe, officers could go on functioning serenely and take initiatives of no immediate relevance, and often unknown to the highest authority, purely and simply because they had been created originally for this purpose. The next phase was at once the easiest and the hardest for Humbert. It was a period of sheer lethargy. He had gone the round of officers, taken every step that could be taken, and realized that for the present all avenues of that kind were closed to him. So now he drifted aimlessly from café to café. In the mornings he would sit on the terrace of one of them and read a newspaper in the hope of finding some indication that the epidemic was on the wane. He would gaze at the faces of the passers-by, often turning away disgustedly from their look of unrelieved gloom, and after reading for the nth time the shop signs on the other side of the street, the advertisements of popular drinks that were no longer procurable, would rise and walk again at random in the yellow streets. Thus he killed time till nightfall, moving about the town and stopping now and then at a café or restaurant. One evening, Rieux noticed him hovering around the door of a café, unable to make up his mind to enter. At last he decided to go in and sat down at a table at the back of the room. It was the time when, acting under orders, café proprietors deferred as long as possible turning on their lights. Grey dusk was seeping into the room, the pink of sunset glowed in the wall mirrors, and the marble-topped tables glimmered white in the gathering darkness. Seated in the empty café, Humbert looked pathetically lost, a mere shade among the shadows, and Rieux guessed this was the hour when he felt most derelict. It was, indeed, the hour of day when all the prisoners of the town realized their dereliction, and each was thinking that something, no matter what, must be done to hasten their deliverance. Rieux turned hurriedly away. Humbert also spent a certain amount of time at the railroad stations. No one was allowed on the platforms, but the waiting rooms, which could be entered from outside, remained open, and, being cool and dark, were often patronized by beggars on very hot days. Humbert spent much time studying the timetables, reading the prohibitions against spitting, and the passengers' regulations. After that, he sat down in a corner. An old cast-iron stove, which had been stone-cold for months, rose like a sort of landmark in the middle of the room, surrounded by figure-of-eight patterns on the floor, the traceries of long-past sprinklings. Posters on the walls gaily invited tourists to a carefree holiday at Cannes or Bandol. And in his corner, Humbert savored that bitter sense of freedom which comes of total deprivation. The evocations which at that time he found most poignant were, anyhow, according to what he told Rieux, those of Paris. There rose before his eyes, unsummoned, vistas of old stones and river banks, the pigeons of the Palais Royal, the Gare du Nord, quiet old streets around the Pantheon, and many another scene of the city he'd never known he loved so much. And these mental pictures killed all desire for any form of action. Rieux felt fairly sure he was identifying these scenes with memories of his love. And when one day Humbert told him that he liked waking up at 4 in the morning and thinking of his beloved Paris, the doctor guessed easily enough, basing this on his own experience, that that was his favorite time for conjuring up pictures of the woman from whom he now was parted. This was indeed the hour when he could feel surest she was wholly his. Till 4 in the morning, one is seldom doing anything, and at that hour, even if the night has been a night of betrayal, one is asleep. Yes, everyone sleeps at that hour, and this is reassuring, since the great longings of an unquiet heart is to possess constantly and consciously the loved one, or, failing that, to be able to plunge the loved one, when a time of absence intervenes, into a dreamless sleep, timed to last unbroken until the day they meet again. Shortly after Father Panelou's sermon, the hot weather set in with a vengeance. On the day following the unseasonable downpour of that Sunday, summer blazed out above the housetops. First, a strong, scorching wind blew steadily for a whole day, drying up the walls. Then the sun took charge. Incessant waves of heat and light swept the town day long. And but for arcaded streets and the interiors of houses, everything lay naked to the dazzling impact of the light. The sun stalked our townsfolk along every byway into every nook, and when they paused, it struck. Since this first onslaught of the heat, synchronized with a startling increase in the number of victims, there were now nearly 700 deaths a week, a mood of profound discouragement settled on the town. In the suburbs, little was left of the wonted animation between the long, flat streets and the terraced houses. Ordinarily, people living in these districts used to spend the best part of the day on their doorsteps, but now every door was shut, nobody was to be seen. Even the Venetian blinds stayed down, and there was no knowing if it was the heat or the plague that they were trying to shut out. In some houses, groans could be heard. At first, when that happened, people often gathered outside and listened, prompted by curiosity or compassion. But under the prolonged strain, it seemed that hearts had toughened. People lived beside those groans or walked past them, as though they'd become the normal speech of men. As a result of the fighting at the gates, in the course of which the police had had to use their revolvers, a spirit of lawlessness was abroad. Some had certainly been wounded in these brushes with the police, but in the town, where owing to the combined influences of heat and terror, everything was exaggerated, there was talk of deaths. One thing, anyhow, was certain. Discontent was on the increase, and fearing worse to come, the local officials debated lengthily on the measures to be taken if the populace, goaded to frenzy by the epidemic, got completely out of hand. The newspapers published new regulations reiterating the orders against attempting to leave the town and warning those who infringed them that they were liable to long terms of imprisonment. A system of patrols was instituted, and often in the empty, sweltering streets, heralded by a clatter of horse hoofs on the cobbles, a detachment of mounted police would make its way between the parallel lines of close-shut windows. Now and again, a gunshot was heard. The special brigade recently detailed to destroy cats and dogs as possible carriers of infection was at work. And these whip-crack sounds, startling the silence, increased the nervous tension already existing in the town. For in the heat and stillness, and for the troubled hearts of our townsfolk, anything, even the least sound, had a heightened significance. The varying aspects of the sky, the very smells rising from the soil that mark each change of season, were taken notice of for the first time. Everyone realized with dismay that hot weather would favor the epidemic, and it was clear that summer was setting in. The cries of swifts in the evening air above the housetops were growing shriller, and the sky, too, had lost the spaciousness of those June twilights when our horizon seemed infinitely remote. In the markets, the flowers no longer came in buds. They were already in full bloom. And after the morning's marketing, the dusty pavements were littered with trampled petals. It was plain to see that spring had spent itself, lavished its ardor on the myriads of flowers that were bursting everywhere into bloom, and now was being crushed out by the twofold onslaught of heat and plague. For our fellow citizens, that summer sky and the streets thick with dust, gray as their present lives, had the same ominous import as the 100 deaths now weighing daily on the town. That incessant sunlight and those bright hours associated with siesta or with holidays no longer invited, as in the past, to frolics and flirtation on the beaches. Now they rang hollow in the silence of the closed town. They had lost the golden spell of happier summers. Plague had killed all colors, vetoed pleasure. That, indeed, was one of the great changes brought by the epidemic. Hitherto, all of us welcomed summer in with pleasant anticipation. The town was open to the sea, and its young folk made free of the beaches. But this summer, for all its nearness, the sea was out of bounds. Young limbs had no longer the run of its delights. What could we do under these conditions? It is Tarou who once again paints the most faithful picture of our life in those days. Needless to say, he outlines the progress of the plague, and he too notes that a new phase of the epidemic was ushered in when the radio announced no longer weekly totals, but 92, 107, and 130 deaths in a day. The newspapers and the authorities are playing ball with the plague. They fancy they're scoring off it because 130 is a smaller figure than 910. He also records such striking or moving incidents of the epidemic as came under his notice. That, for instance, of the woman in a lonely street who abruptly opened the shuttered window just above his head and gave two loud shrieks before closing the shutters again on the dark interior of a bedroom. But he also noted that peppermint lozenges had vanished from the drugstores, because there was a popular belief that when sucking them, you were proof against contagion. He went on watching his pet specimen on the opposite balcony. It seemed the tragedy had come to the ancient small game hunter as well. One morning, there had been gunshots in the street, and, as Tarou puts it, some gobs of lead had killed off most of the cats and scared away the others. Anyhow, they were no longer about. That day, the little old man went onto his balcony at the usual hour, showed some surprise, and, leaning on the rail, closely scanned the corners of the street. Then he settled down to wait, fretfully tapping the balustrade with his right hand. After staying there for some time, he tore up a few sheets of paper, went back into his room, and came out again. After another longish wait, he retreated again into the room, slamming the French windows behind him. He followed the same procedure daily during the rest of the week, and the sadness and bewilderment on the old face deepened as the days went by. On the eighth day, Tao waited in vain for his appearance. The windows stayed resolutely closed on all too comprehensible distress. This entry ends with Tao's summing up. It is forbidden to spit on cats in plague time. In another context, Tao notes that on coming home in the evenings, he invariably saw the night watchman pacing the hall like a sentry on his beat. The man never failed to remind everyone he met that he'd foreseen what was happening. Tao agreed that he'd predicted a disaster, but reminded him that the event predicted by him was an earthquake, to which the old fellow replied, "Ah, if only it had been an earthquake. A good, bad shock, and there you are. You count the dead and living, and that's an end of it. But this here damned disease, even them who haven't got it can't think of anything else." The manager of the hotel was equally downhearted. In the early days, travelers, unable to leave the town, had kept on their rooms. But one by one, seeing that the epidemic showed no signs of abating, they moved out to stay with friends. And the same cause that had led to all the rooms being occupied now kept them empty, since there were no newcomers to the town. Tao was one of the few remaining guests, and the manager never lost an opportunity of informing him that, were he not reluctant to put these gentlemen to inconvenience, he would have closed the hotel long ago. He often asked Tao to say how long he thought the epidemic would last. "They say," Tao informed him, "that cold weather stamps out diseases of this type." The manager looked aghast. "But my dear sir, it's never really cold in these parts. And anyhow, that would mean it's going to last many months more." Moreover, he was sure that for a long while to come, travelers would give the town a wide berth. This epidemic spelt the ruin of the tourist trade, in fact. After a short absence, Monsieur Houton, the owlish paterfamilias, made a reappearance in the restaurant, but accompanied only by the two performing poodles, his offspring. On inquiry, it came out that Madame Houton was in quarantine. She had been nursing her mother, who had succumbed to plague. "I don't like it a bit," the manager told Tao. "Quarantine or not, she's under suspicion, which means that they are too." Tao pointed out that if it came to that, everyone was under suspicion. But the manager had his own ideas and was not to be shaken out of them. "No, sir. You and I, we're not under suspicion, but they certainly are." However, Monsieur Houton was impervious to such considerations and would not let the plague change his habits. He entered the restaurant with his wonted dignity, sat down in front of his children, and addressed to them at intervals the same nicely worded, unamiable remarks. Only the small boy looked somewhat different. Dressed in black like his sister, a little more shrunken than before, he now seemed a miniature replica of his father. The night watchman, who had no liking for Monsieur Houton, had said of him to Tao, "That fine gentleman will pass out with his clothes on, all dressed up and ready to go, so he won't need no laying out." Tao has some comments on the sermon preached by Panelou. "I can understand that type of fervor and find it not displeasing. At the beginning of a pestilence, and when it ends, there's always a propensity for rhetoric. In the first case, habits have not yet been lost. In the second, they're returning. It is in the thick of a calamity that one gets hardened to the truth. In other words, to silence. So let's wait." Tao also records that he had a long talk with Dr. Rieu. All he remembered was that it had good results. In this connection, he notes the color of Madame Rieu's, the doctor's mother's, eyes, a limpid brown, and makes the odd observation that a gaze revealing so much goodness of heart would always triumph over plague. He has also a good deal to say about Rieu's asthma patient. He went with the doctor to see him immediately after their conversation. The old man greeted Tao with a chuckle and rubbed his hands cheerfully. He was sitting up in bed with the usual two pans of dried peas in front of him. "Ah, here's another of them," he exclaimed when he saw Tao. "It's a topsy-turvy world, all right. More doctors than patients. Because it's mowing them down, ain't it? More and more. That priest's right. We were asking for it." Next day, Tao came to see him without warning. From Tao's notes, we gather that the old man, a dry goods dealer by occupation, decided at the age of 50 that he'd done enough work for a lifetime. He took to his bed and never left it again, but not because of his asthma, which would not have prevented his getting about. A small fixed income had seen him through to his present age, 75, and the years had not damped his cheerfulness. He couldn't bear the sight of a watch, and indeed there wasn't one in the whole house. Watches, he said, are silly gadgets, and dear at that. He worked out the time, that is to say, the time for meals, with his two saucepans, one of which was always full of peas when he woke in the morning. He filled the other, pea by pea, at a constant, carefully regulated speed. Thus, time for him was reckoned by these pans, and he could take his bearings in it at any moment of the day. Every 15 pans, he said, it's feeding time. What could be simpler? If his wife was to be trusted, he had given signs of his vocation at a very early age. Nothing, in fact, had ever interested him. His work, friendship, cafes, music, women, outings, to all, he was indifferent. He had never left his hometown except once when he'd been called to Algiers for family affairs, and even then he had alighted from the train at the first station after Oran, incapable of continuing the adventure. He took the first train back. Toutaou, who had shown surprise at the secluded life he led, he had given the following explanation, more or less. According to religion, the first half of a man's life is an upgrade. The second goes downhill. On the descending days, he has no claim. They may be snatched from him at any moment. Thus, he can do nothing with them, and the best thing, precisely, is to do nothing with them. He obviously had no compunction about contradicting himself, for a few minutes later he told Tahu that God did not exist, since otherwise there would be no need for priests. But from some observations which followed, Tahu realized that the old fellow's philosophy was closely involved with the irritation caused by the house-to-house collections in aid of charities, which took place almost incessantly in that part of town. What completed the picture of the old man was a desire he expressed several times, and which seemed deeply rooted, the desire to die at a very advanced age. Is he a saint? Tao asked himself, and answered, yes, if saintliness is an aggregate of habits. Meanwhile, Tao was compiling a longish description of a day in the plague-stricken town. It was to give a full and accurate picture of the life of our fellow citizens during that summer. Nobody laughs, Tao observes, except the drunks, and they laugh too much. After which, he embarks on his description. At daybreak, light breaths of air fanned the still empty streets. At this hour, between the night's victims and the death agonies of the coming day, it is as if, for a while, plague stays its hand and takes breath. All shops are shut. But on some, a notice, closed owing to plague, shows that when the others open presently, these will not. Still half asleep, the newsboys do not yet cry the news, but, lounging at street corners, offer their wares to the lampposts with the vague gestures of sleepwalkers. Soon, awakened by the early streetcars, they will fan out through the town, holding at arm's length sheets on which the word plague looms large. Will there be a plague autumn? Professor B says, no. Toll of the 94th day of plague, 124 deaths. In spite of the growing shortage of paper, which has compelled some dailies to reduce their pages, a new paper has been launched. The Plague Chronicle, which sets out, quote, to inform our townspeople with scrupulous veracity of the daily progress or recession of the disease, to supply them with the most authoritative opinions available as to its future course, to offer the hospitality of its columns to all, in whatever walk of life, who wish to join in combating the epidemic, to keep up the morale of the populace, to publish the latest orders issued by the authorities, and to centralize the efforts of all who desire to give active and wholehearted help in the present emergency, came to devote its columns to advertisements of new, infallible antidotes against plague. Toward 6 in the morning, all these papers are being sold to the lines that begin to form outside the shops over an hour before they open, then to the passengers alighting from the streetcars coming in, packed to capacity from the suburbs. The cars are now the only means of transport, and they have much difficulty in progressing, what with people standing on the running boards and hanging in clusters from the handrails. A queer thing is how the passengers all try to keep their backs turned to their neighbors, twisting themselves into grotesque attitudes in the attempt, the idea being, of course, to avoid contagion. At every stop, a cataract of men and women is disgorged, each in haste to put a safe distance between himself or herself and the rest. When the first cars have gone by, the town gradually wakes up, early cafes open their doors, and you see an array of cards on the counter. No coffee, bring your own sugar, and the like. Next, the shops open, and the streets grow livelier. and meanwhile the light is swelling and the sky, even at this early hour, beginning to grow leaden-hued with heat. This is the time when those who have nothing to do venture out on the boulevards. Most of them seem determined to counteract the plague by a lavish display of luxury. Daily, about 11, you see a sort of dress parade of youths and girls who make you realize the frantic desire for life that thrives in the heart of every great calamity. If the epidemic spread, morals too will broaden, and we may see again the Saturnalia of Milan, men and women dancing around the graves. At noon, in a flash, all the restaurants fill up. Very quickly, small groups of people, unable to find a seat, form at the doors. Because of the intense heat, the sky is losing its brightness. Under big awnings, the aspirants to food wait their turn, aligned along the curbs of streets, gaping and sizzling in the fires of noon. The reason for the restaurants being so crowded is that they solve for many the feeding problem, but they do nothing to allay the fear of contagion. Many of the customers spend several minutes methodically wiping their plates. Not long ago, some restaurants put up notices: "Our plates, knives, and forks guaranteed sterilized." But gradually they discontinued publicity of this order, since their customers came in any case. People, moreover, spend very freely. Choice wines, or wines alleged to be such, the costliest extras, a mood of reckless extravagance is setting in. It seems that there was something like a panic in a restaurant because a customer suddenly felt ill, went very white, and staggered precipitately to the door. Toward 2 o'clock, the town slowly empties. It is the time when silence, sunlight, dust, and plague have the streets to themselves. Wave after wave of heat flows over the frontage of the tall gray houses during these long, languid hours. Thus the afternoon wears on, slowly merging into an evening that settles down like a red winding sheet on the serried tumult of the town. At the start of the great heat, for some unascertained reason, the evenings found the streets almost empty. But now, the least ripple of cooler air brings an easing of the strain, if not a flutter of hope. Then all stream out into the open, drug themselves with talking, start arguing or lovemaking, and in the last glow of sunset, the town, freighted with lovers two by two and loud with voices, drifts like a helmless ship into the throbbing darkness. In vain, a zealous evangelist with a felt hat and flowing tie threads his way through the crowd, crying without cease, "God is great and good, come unto him." On the contrary, they all make haste toward some trivial objective that seems of more immediate interest than God. In the early days, when they thought this epidemic was much like other epidemics, religion held its ground. But once these people realized their instant peril, they gave their thoughts to pleasure. And all the hideous fears that stamp their faces in the daytime are transformed in the fiery, dusty nightfall into a sort of hectic exaltation, an unkempt freedom fevering their blood. And I, too, I'm no different. But what matter? Death means nothing to men like me. It's the event that proves them right. It was Tahu who had asked Grieux for the interview he refers to in his diary. On that evening, as it happened, just before Tahu arrived, the doctor had gazed for some moments at his mother, who was sitting very still in a corner of the dining room. Once her household tasks were over, she spent most of her time in that chair. Her hands folded in her lap, she sat there waiting. Grieux wasn't even sure it was for him she waited. However, something always changed in his mother's face when he came in. The silent resignation that a laborious life had given it seemed to light up with a sudden glow. Then she returned to her tranquility. That evening she was gazing out of the window at the now empty street. The street lighting had been reduced by 2/3, and only at long intervals a lamp cast flickering gleams through the thick darkness of the town. "Will they keep to the reduced lighting as long as the plague lasts?" Madame Rieu asked. "I expect so." "Let's hope it doesn't last till winter. It would be terribly depressing." "Yes," Rieu said. He saw his mother's gaze settle on his forehead. He knew that the worry and overwork of the last few days had scored their traces there. "Didn't things go well today?" his mother asked. "Oh, much as usual." "As usual. That was to say, the new consignment of serum sent from Paris seemed less effective than the first, and the death rate was rising. It was still impossible to administer prophylactic inoculations elsewhere than in families already attacked. If its use was to be generalized, very large quantities of the vaccine would have been needed. Most of the buboes refused to burst. It was as if they underwent a seasonal hardening, and the victims suffered horribly. During the last 24 hours, there'd been two cases of a new form of the epidemic. The plague was becoming pneumonic. On this very day, in the course of a meeting, the much-harassed doctors had pressed the prefect, the unfortunate man seemed quite at his wit's end, to issue new regulations to prevent contagion being carried from mouth to mouth, as happens in pneumonic plague. The prefect had done as they wished, but, as usual, they were groping, more or less in the dark. Looking at his mother, he felt an uprush of a half-forgotten emotion, the love of his boyhood, at the sight of her soft brown gaze intent on him. "Don't you ever feel alarmed, mother?" "Oh, at my age, there isn't much left to fear. The days are very long, and just now I'm hardly ever at home. I don't mind waiting, if I know you're going to come back. And when you aren't here, I think of what you're doing. Have you any news?" "Yes. If I'm to believe the last telegram, everything's going as well as could be expected. But I know she says that to prevent my worrying." The doorbell rang. The doctor gave his mother a smile and went to open the door. In the dim light on the landing, Tarou looked like a big gray bear. Rieu gave his visitor a seat facing his desk, while he himself remained standing behind the desk chair. Between them was the only light in the room, a desk lamp. Tarou came straight to the point. "I know," he said, "that I can talk to you quite frankly." Rieu nodded. "In a fortnight, or a month at most," Tarou continued, "you'll serve no purpose here. Things will have got out of hand." "I agree." "The sanitary department is inefficient, understaffed for one thing, and you're worked off your feet." Rieu admitted this was so. "Well," Tarou said, "I've heard that the authorities are thinking of a sort of conscription of the population, and all men in good health will be required to help in fighting the plague. Your information was correct, but the authorities are none too good odor as it is, and the prefect can't make up his mind. Well, if you daren't risk compulsion, why not call for voluntary help?" "It's been done." The response was poor. "It was done through official channels and half-heartedly. What they're short on is imagination. Officialdom can never cope with something really catastrophic, and the remedial measures they think up are hardly adequate for a common cold. If we let them carry on like this, they'll soon be dead, and so shall we." "That's more than likely," Ayer said. "I should tell you, however, that they're thinking of using the prisoners in the jails for what we call the heavy work. I'd rather free men were employed." "So would I. But might I ask why you feel like that?" "I loathe men's being condemned to death." Rieu looked Tarou in the eyes. "So what?" he asked. "It's this I have to say. I've drawn up a plan for voluntary groups of helpers. Get me empowered to try out my plan, and then let's sidetrack officialdom. In any case, the authorities have their hands more than full already. I have friends in many walks of life. They'll form a nucleus to start from. And, of course, I'll take part in it myself." "I need hardly tell you," Rieu replied, "that I accept your suggestion most gladly. One can't have too many helpers, especially in a job like mine under present conditions. I undertake to get your plan approved by the authorities. Anyhow, they've no choice. But," Rieu pondered, "but I take it you know that work of this kind may prove fatal to the worker. And I feel I should ask you this. Have you weighed the dangers?" Tarou's gray eyes met the doctor's gaze serenely. "What did you think of Panlou's sermon, doctor?" The question was asked in a quite ordinary tone, and Rieu answered in the same tone. "I've seen too much of hospitals to relish any idea of collective punishment. But, as you know, Christians sometimes say that sort of thing without really thinking it. They're better than they seem. However, you think, like Panlou, that the plague has its good side. It opens men's eyes and forces them to take thought." The doctor tossed his head impatiently. "So does every ill that flesh is heir to. What's true of all the evils in the world is true of plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves. All the same, when you see the misery it brings, you need to be a madman or a coward, or stone blind, to give in tamely to the plague." Rieu had hardly raised his voice at all, but Tarou made a slight gesture as if to calm him. He was smiling. "Yes," Rieu shrugged his shoulders. "But you haven't answered my question yet. Have you weighed the consequences?" Tarou squared his shoulders against the back of the chair, then moved his head forward into the light. "Do you believe in God, doctor?" Again, the question was put in an ordinary tone. But this time, Rieu took longer to find his answer. "No, But what does that really mean? I'm fumbling in the dark, struggling to make something out, but I've long ceased finding that original. Isn't that it? The gulf between Panlu and you? I doubt it. Panlu is a man of learning, a scholar. He hasn't come in contact with death. That's why he can speak with such assurance of the truth, with a capital T. But every country priest who visits his parishioners and has heard a man gasping for breath on his deathbed thinks as I do. He tried to relieve human suffering before trying to point out its excellence. Rieu stood up. His face was now in shadow. Let's drop the subject, he said, as you won't answer. Daru remained seated in his chair. He was smiling again. Supposing I answer with a question. The doctor now smiled too. You like being mysterious, don't you? Yes. Fire away. My question's this, said Daru. Why do you yourself show such devotion, considering you don't believe in God? I suspect your answer may help me to mine. His face still in shadow, Rieu said that he'd already answered, that if he believed in an all-powerful God, he would cease curing the sick and leave that to him. But no one in the world believed in a God of that sort. No, not even Panlu, who believed that he believed in such a God. And this was proved by the fact that no one ever threw himself on Providence completely. Anyhow, in this respect, Rieu believed himself to be on the right road, in fighting against creation as he found it. Ah, Tao remarked. So that's the idea you have of your profession. More or less. The doctor came back into the light. Tao made a faint whistling noise with his lips, and the doctor gazed at him. Yes, you're thinking it calls for pride to feel that way. But I assure you, I've no more than the pride that's needed to keep me going. I've no idea what's awaiting me or what will happen when all this ends. For the moment, I know this. There are sick people, and they need curing. Later on, perhaps, they'll think things over, and so shall I. But what's wanted now is to make them well. I defend them as best I can, that's all. Against whom? Rieu turned to the window. A shadow line on the horizon told of the presence of the sea. He was conscious only of his exhaustion, and at the same time was struggling against a sudden irrational impulse to unburden himself a little more to his companion, an eccentric perhaps, but who he guessed was one of his own kind. I haven't a notion, Tarou. I assure you I haven't a notion. When I entered this profession, I did it abstractedly, so to speak, because I had a desire for it, because it meant a career like another, one that young men often aspire to. Perhaps, too, because it was particularly difficult for a workman's son like myself. And then I had to see people die. Do you know that there are some who refuse to die? Have you ever heard a woman scream, never, with her last gasp? Well, I have. And then I saw that I could never get hardened to it. I was young then, and I was outraged by the whole scheme of things, or so I thought. Subsequently, I grew more modest. Only I've never managed to get used to seeing people die. That's all I know. Yet, after all, Rieu fell silent and sat down. He felt his mouth dry. After all, Tarou prompted softly. After all, the doctor repeated, then hesitated again, fixing his eyes on Tarou. It's something that a man of your sort can understand, most likely. But since the order of the world is shaped by death, mightn't it be better for God if we refuse to believe in him and struggle with all our might against death without raising our eyes toward the heaven where he sits in silence? Tarou nodded. Yes. But your victories will never be lasting, that's all. Rieu's face darkened. Yes, I know that. But it's no reason for giving up the struggle. No reason, I agree. Only I now can picture what this plague must mean for you. Yes. A never-ending defeat. Tarou stared at the doctor for a moment, then turned and tramped heavily toward the door. Rieu followed him and was almost at his side when Tarou, who was staring at the floor, suddenly said, "Who taught you all this, doctor?" The reply came promptly, "Suffering." Rieu opened the door of his surgery and told Tarou that he too was going out. He had a patient to visit in the suburbs. Tarou suggested they should go together, and he agreed. In the hall, they encountered Madame Rieu, and the doctor introduced Tarou to her. A friend of mine, he said. Indeed, said Madame Brieux. I am very pleased to make your acquaintance. When she left them, Tarot turned to gaze after her. On the landing, the doctor pressed a switch to turn on the lights along the stairs, but the stairs remained in darkness. Possibly some new light-saving order had come into force. Really, however, there was no knowing. For some time past, in the streets, no less than in private houses, everything had been going out of order. It might be only that the concierge, like nearly everyone in the town, was ceasing to bother about his duties. The doctor had no time to follow up his thoughts. Tao's voice came from behind him. Just one word more, doctor, even if it sounds to you a bit nonsensical. You're perfectly right. The doctor merely gave a little shrug, unseen in the darkness. To tell the truth, all that's outside my range. But you, what do you know about it? Ah, Tao replied quite coolly, I've little left to learn. Hilliard paused, and behind him Tao's foot slipped on a step. He steadied himself by gripping the doctor's shoulder. Do you really imagine that you know everything about life? The answer came through the darkness in the same cool, confident tone. Yes. Once in the street, they realized it must be quite late. 11, perhaps. All was silence in the town, except for some vague rustlings. An ambulance bell clanged faintly in the distance. They stepped into the car, and Rieu started the engine. You must come to the hospital tomorrow, he said, for an injection. But before embarking on this adventure, you'd better know your chances of coming out of it alive. They're 1 in 3. That sort of reckoning doesn't hold water. You know it, doctor, as well as I. 100 years ago, plague wiped out the entire population of a town in Persia, with one exception. And the sole survivor was precisely the man whose job it was to wash the dead bodies and who carried on throughout the epidemic. Well, he pulled off his 1 in 3 chance, that's all. Rieu had lowered his voice. But you're right. We know next to nothing on the subject. They were entering the suburbs. The headlights lit up empty streets. The car stopped. Standing in front of it, Rieu asked Tao if he'd like to come in. Tao said, yes. A glimmer of light from the sky lit up their faces. Suddenly, Rieu gave a short laugh, and there was much friendliness in it. Out with it, Tao. What on earth prompted you to take a hand in this? I don't know. My code of morals, perhaps. Your code of morals? What code? Comprehension. Tao turned toward the house, and Rieu did not see his face again until they were in the old asthma patient's room. Next day, Tao set to work and enrolled a first team of workers, soon to be followed by many others. However, it is not the narrator's intention to ascribe to these sanitary groups more importance than their due. Doubtless today, many of our fellow citizens are apt to yield to the temptation of exaggerating the services they rendered. But the narrator is inclined to think that by attributing overimportance to praiseworthy actions, one may, by implication, be paying indirect but potent homage to the worst side of human nature. For this attitude implies that such actions shine out as rare exceptions, while callousness and apathy are the general rule. The narrator does not share that view. The evil that is in the world always comes of ignorance, and good intentions may do as much harm as malevolence if they lack understanding.